a circle is a square, a negative is a positive. What? Doesn't make any sense. It's just words thrown together. Now, actually, I'll give you another exercise. I played a little trick on a Muslim friend of mine. Maybe he should have known better, but he didn't. I was riding with him, and I said, okay, can God create another God? I was just testing him. Can God create another God? He said, yeah, because automatically you want to believe that God can do anything. He can do whatever he wants. And I said, no, God cannot create another God. Do you know why? Does anybody know why? Just raise your hand if you know why. One person knows why. Oh, that's good enough. Oh, two. Okay. All right. Two out of like 300 people. Okay. No. The reason is because the moment that being that God creates is created, from that moment he's not God because he was created. God is uncreated. You can't create God. We're not limiting God. It's just impossible. It's a sentence that doesn't mean anything. Another problem in Christian arguing is the tendency of some of them, again, this is all in generalities. A lot of Christians aren't this way. But there's a tendency of some of them to puff up words. They tell us that something means more than it actually says. How many Muslims? I only want the Muslims to answer this. If you're not a Muslim, don't raise your hand and answer this question. How many Muslims have heard this verse quoted to you by a Christian where Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to God but through me? How many? A lot of you. You've all heard it, right? Okay. Well, you can ask people who say that, have you ever looked up the definition of way, truth, and life in the dictionary? Beside none of them do you find the word God. Not there. Way is means. That which you require to get to heaven. I believe Jesus is the way. It's something any prophet could say. Truth, that which is true. Saying, watch out for liars. Life, and that's the big one. That's where they say, Jesus is the life. If you don't have the life, you're lost. The life is Jesus. They're still puffing up words. The, as if the word the has some special meaning. Jesus is the life. Well, Bill Clinton said, I am the president. Did that mean there was never one before and there was never going to be another one? I'm the president. You know what I'm talking about. I don't think so. They get all in a fuss over this term, the life. But if you ask them who wrote the book of Proverbs in the Bible, they'll say Solomon. In Arabic, we call him Suleiman. He's the author of the Proverbs according to the majority of Christians. Now, if you read Proverbs chapter 8, verse 35, Solomon informs you, whoever finds me finds life. Well, apparently, Jesus wasn't the life. Solomon was. And so was Jesus. There's another very famous verse where Jesus reportedly says, I have come that they may have life and have it more abundantly. In this place, life seems to be something you can have more or less of. It's not a yes or no situation. Sometimes when talking to a Christian, you'll find that they maybe have an improper understanding of Scripture that you can help them with. Some of them, again, speaking in generalities. The best example I can give you is their definition of the word Messiah. Messiah. It's in Greek, it's a Hebrew word. In Greek, it's translated Christ. You ask somebody, where did Jesus say he was God? And they'll point to you a verse in the Bible that says the high priest is questioning Jesus, Caiaphas, the high priest, and he says, are you the Messiah? Jesus says, yes, it is as you say. And Caiaphas yells, blasphemy! And he tears his garments. Right there, they say, see? He said he was God right there. It's blasphemy. He said he was the Messiah. What does the word Messiah mean? It means anointed. If you read the Old Testament, David, Solomon, Cyrus the Persian, all called Messiahs. Cyrus the Persian didn't even believe in God, according to the book of Isaiah. God's talking to him and says, you have not known me. And he's called a Messiah. Pots and pans are made anointed. They're made Messiahs. Pillars, Messiahs. In the Gospel of Matthew, towards the end, sick people are anointed. Sick people are made Messiahs. It's a word that has no meaning, but some of them try to trick you. They say, Jesus, in your Quran, he's called the Messiah, right? Yeah, he's called the Messiah. Was Muhammad called the Messiah? No. Oh, 2 points for Jesus. Muhammad, zero. That's what they do. They'll say, okay, you believe Jesus rose to heaven, right? Right, yeah. Muhammad, where is he? He's in the grave, right? Yeah, Muhammad, Sufi Islam, he's in the grave. Maybe his bones are starting to rot. You don't know. Maybe. Kind of a tricky issue, but maybe. You say, yeah, maybe. Okay, 2 points for Jesus. 4 for Jesus, 0 for Muhammad. These things don't mean anything. In the Old Testament, Elijah ascended to heaven without ever having death come to him. Escaped death. And various other things. They'll say, you know, Jesus healed people. Did Muhammad heal people? Well, no, Muhammad performed some other miracles, but no, he didn't really heal anybody. Okay, 2 points for Jesus. See, Jesus gets all these points, and you're Muhammad, he's nowhere. That's what they say, some of them. Well, in the Old Testament, Elias, I believe it was, his dead body heals a sick person. Somebody just happens to walk into his tomb and rub up against his body, and it heals somebody, a dead body. It means nothing. It's nothing special. The word Messiah is nothing special. In the Quran, every prophet has his own particular name. Jesus is the Messiah. Abraham is called the friend of God. Does that mean every other prophet was his enemy? Of course not. Muhammad, said the Islam, called Mustafa, chosen one. Does that mean every other prophet wasn't chosen? Of course not. So we can help some of them with a proper understanding of their own scripture. Another example is when Christians, some of them, again, go the wrong way with an argument. An argument is supposed to go A means B, not B means A. And I'll give you an example. You ask a Christian, how do you know Jesus is God? Well, he performed miracles. That's B means A. That's like looking outside and seeing the streets are wet and saying the streets are wet, therefore it rained. There could be other reasons the streets are wet. The water main burst, somebody sprayed it with a water hose, the snow melted. There could be various reasons why the streets are wet. There could be various reasons why Jesus performed miracles to show that his message was true, that he was really sent from God. It doesn't really mean a whole lot of anything. It's just going the wrong way with an argument. By saying Jesus performed miracles and therefore he's God, you can go the other way with it. You can say Jesus is God and that's why he performed miracles, but then you're left with a burden of proof of proving that Jesus said he was God. And that's a big problem. Another question that's going to kind of wrap up, and then we're going to take a little break, because I could go on forever. Who is Jesus in the Bible? There's some interesting things that are typically overlooked. 83 times in the New Testament, Jesus is referred to as the Son of Man. 83 times he calls himself the Son of Man. Actually, a little bit less than that, but he calls himself the Son of Man more than he refers to himself as the Son of God. He refers to himself as the Son of God only once, and that's in John chapter 10, and that is to disprove something some of the Jews were trying to say to him. Actually, it's an interesting story, but I'm not going to get into that. Every other time he refers to himself as the Son of Man, this title, the Son of Man. The only definition of the Son of Man that we have is in the Old Testament, Job chapter 25, and it says, a Son of Man is but a worm. And I think we're going to take just a quick break here. Let him change the tape up there. So we'll take a quick break. If you want to go ahead and get some refreshments when we come back, it's just going to be about 5 or 10 minutes. Please don't leave because we're going to start talking about evolution. Don't come up here and try to debate me yet. You'll get all the chance to debate me after the lecture is over. I'll stay here all night with you. So. A little worried. You ready? All right. We're starting again. The break is over. We're going to start talking about atheism now. So now you atheists, after you heard what I said about Christianity, maybe some of you are starting to shake a little bit, get a little worried. You should be. Okay, if you noticed with Christianity, kind of what I did is I addressed some of the philosophies of Christianity. And then I addressed some of the doctrine, the hardcore cornerstone of their faith kind of ideas. Now, I'm going to do the same with atheism. I'm going to address some philosophies, some problems in the way that some atheists think. And then I'm going to address the cornerstone of their belief, which is evolution. The first thing you'll usually run into when you're basically talking to an atheist, sometimes they'll confront you. They'll come up and say, I don't believe in God. You can't prove to me that God exists. They've overstepped some important steps there. Most importantly, the one where you should ask them, which God don't you believe in? Because most probably I don't believe in him either. If you don't believe in the God that was in the book of Genesis, walking through the garden like a human being, saying, Adam, where are you? Because he couldn't find him. The God that created the heavens and the earth in 6 days and then took a rest. Or the God that rode the horse and the donkey at the same time into the gate of Jerusalem. Most probably I don't believe in that God either. And that's the first step. A lot of times, though, atheists feel very secure in their belief for one reason. And you'll get this a lot. They'll hide behind this idea that look at all the bloodshed religion has caused, all the problems You disagree with each other and you fight each other and you kill each other all the time. And it's even happening today. You've never heard of an atheist killing anybody. There's no tenets of atheism that have anything to do with racism or thinking somebody's better than somebody or killing somebody or oppressing somebody. That's what they think. Some of them. Not all of them. Some of them. The question is that true? No, it's not. I'll give you an example. China, to this day, is oppressing people who have any religious belief. They are forcing atheism on people because they want complete loyalty to the government. So for decades, they've been persecuting Christians, Muslims, and Buddhists. Some of the Buddhists and some of the Muslims have fought back. Now, atheists will sometimes say, well, you know, that's an extreme. You know, they've chosen to do that. But atheism in itself and evolutionism doesn't teach these things. It doesn't have any, you know, doctrine of violence or bloodshed or anything like that. But religion does. Well, that makes me have to address a side point. Islam is not this big, bad terror boogeyman that everybody's made it out to be. Yes, there are verses in the Quran that are harsh and that talk about war. There are things in the Hadith which are harsh, and they talk about war. But when you get down to the basic fundamentals, a war can only be launched in Islam in two cases. One is in self-defense. Somebody's going to attack you, you have the right to defend yourself. Don't just stand there and get mowed over. The other is the one like a lot of people like to manipulate and try to make it sound worse than it is. We're allowed to fight if an inherently evil ideology comes into the world. One that causes oppression and mischief and bloodshed. For example, I'll give you an example, Nazis. If the Muslims had been in power when the Nazis started to rise to power, it would have nipped it in the bud because they had an inherently evil ideology. They thought that they could kill somebody just for their belief and because of the way they looked and where they were from. That's against the general idea of utopian society that Islam tries to create. And so immediately Islam, which preaches in the Quran religious freedom and things like this, don't kill, don't oppress, we would have been within our rights under Islamic law to stop Nazism the minute it started to gain power, even if they didn't attack us, simply because it's an evil ideology that came into the world. That's the side point. But the real point is there anything in atheism or evolutionism that can teach violence, racism, bloodshed, and cause some of these things like we see in China today? The answer is yes. The first example I'm going to give you, maybe some of you are familiar with. It's called social Darwinism. Social Darwinism basically states, and it gets this idea from a tenet in evolution, which states that, you're more familiar with this phrase maybe, survival of the fittest. Maybe everybody's heard that. That's an evolutionist phrase. And from that idea comes something called social Darwinism. Social Darwinism states that the strong are strong for a reason and the weak are weak for a reason. And as a result, the strong can do whatever they want to do to the weak. They can manipulate them however they want. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, you saw this everywhere. The rich propagated this idea of social Darwinism. If anybody's ever read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, it's a work of fiction that basically dramatizes what the poor people had to go through. Social Darwinism, thanks to social Darwinism, we can all say thank you to Darwin for some of the things that entered into the world because of social Darwinism, like sweatshops, what we now call sweatshops, child labor, indentured servitude, and murder of any poor person who dared object, basically. And that's the hellish nightmare that we call social Darwinism and the torture that it inflicted upon any poor person. Another example is communism. A form of government which has basically been responsible for the oppression and murder of millions has at its roots evolution and atheistic beliefs. This one maybe some of you don't know, Nazism. If I ask any historian, all I got to do is say this historian's last name, Hickman. You know who I'm talking about. Hickman is a famous historian. And this is what he had to say. Hitler was a firm believer and preacher of evolution. Whatever the deeper, profound perplexities of his psychosis, it is certain that the concept of struggle was important because in his book, Mein Kampf, it clearly set forth a number of evolutionary ideas, particularly those emphasizing struggle, survival of the fittest, and the extermination of the weak to produce a better society. So, we basically have Darwin to thank for Nazism as well. In 1933, Hitler was quoted as saying, "A higher race subjects itself to a lower race. These are the beginnings of the Nazi teachings." And it's also a main tenet of evolutionist belief. So atheism and evolutionism is responsible for some very serious bloodshed, oppression, and murder, just like we are accused as Muslims or any religious person of having in our faith. And it is indoctrinated. It is in their doctrines and in some of their teachings. So don't be fooled, is all I'm saying. Don't be fooled by this thing that some of them say, like, well, evolutionism and atheism doesn't teach to kill people, and we've never, you know, had anything like that. Now, I'm not saying atheists believe this. You know, most atheists, maybe they're not aware of these ideas, because you have to kind of study. A lot of these things are hidden from the main media. But it's there, and that's the main point I wanted to cover. Now, I want to get into Darwin and evolution and cover some of the things they don't teach us in biology class. Some of those things you have to dig real deep to find, or maybe plod through a whole article that's supporting evolutionism to read that quote that just kind of sticks out to you and you think, wait a minute here. And so I'm going to go over some of these things. Now remember, the atheist, their concept of faith, most of them, is in this thing of testable evidence. So we're going to apply testable evidence to evolution and see if it holds up. Why not? Now, is everybody here familiar generally with evolution? Raise your hand if you're at least familiar with it. Everybody, pretty much? Oh, you're not? Okay, that was my wife. She knows all about evolution, trust me. Just to kind of give a brief summation then, we came from monkeys, monkeys came from something else came from something else, until you trace it all the way down to the first single-celled organism that formed all by chance in the ocean. That's basically evolutionism in a nutshell. Something about Darwin that they don't teach us. You know, I was walking through the science hall here, and I saw a big plaque of Darwin, and it said, "A great biologist." The implication here is that he studied biology, and he was a professor, and he knew what he was talking about. That's deceptive. Charles Darwin never underwent a formal education in biology. It was just a hobby. He was called by his friends and his predecessors an amateur naturalist at best. He's not some great biologist. He's somebody that just had a hobby and wrote a book about it. That's it. Now, some of you may not be aware that the book that Darwin wrote stating his theories of evolution is a book called Origin of the Species. What you probably don't know about this book is that there is an entire chapter called Difficulties with the Theory. What he did in this chapter is he took every unresolvable problem and he put it in this chapter. Everything about evolution that disproves evolution that he knew he had to address, he put a label on it and he put it in this chapter. That's what people do when they want to propose a theory, but there's a whole lot of evidence against it. They take all the things they can't resolve and they put a label on it and say, it's here, now I don't have to deal with it. But does putting a label on something really take care of it? I don't think so. One of the examples I can give you from this chapter is the complexities of the eye. Darwin himself admitted that it is impossible to a reasonable thinking entity that all the things needed to form the eye came together by chance. And he says it's an unresolvable problem. And he put a label on it, so now he doesn't have to deal with it. Some of you people who think that Darwin was this great teacher and that knew all this wonderful information and never would have made anything up or said anything that wasn't true. Most of you don't know, he taught racism. In his book, The Descent of Man, he refers to what he calls the greater differences between men of distinct races. He basically held that blacks and aborigines were equal to gorillas and implied that they would be exterminated by the civilized races, which are the whites and the Caucasians. He wrote, and I'm quoting from his book, "At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. At the same time, the anthropomorphous apes will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will be wider, for it will intervene in a more civilized state, as we may hope, even in the Caucasian and some apes as low as baboon, instead of now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla." What he's talking about here, if you didn't get it, is a cute little idea called genocide. That's what he's talking about. When you read something like this, you begin to think, maybe Darwin wasn't a genius. Maybe he wasn't a great biologist. Because that's not true. It's not true that it will ever be okay for one race to exterminate another. It's not true that one race is inferior to another. Both science, reason, and religion All these things together teach us this. So what is that then? It's not true. It's a lie. It's something that he already believed and wanted to collect the evidence to believe that. It reminds me of a story I once heard about a man who wrote a book called Scripture Twisting. And the person, a Muslim, read it, and he wrote a response to the man. And he said, basically in his letter to the author of the book, he said, the Bible doesn't say Jesus is God. The author wrote him back and said, you're right. You can read the whole Bible and not come away with the idea that Jesus is God. But I find he is God because I followed a much simpler method than you. I started out believing he was God, and then I found all the evidence to assume what I already believed. He says, I too am an honest man because this is the way I collect my research. That's not an honest man. The judge doesn't start off a court hearing and say, the man in front of me is guilty and I want all the evidence to support what I've already believed. But that's what Darwin did. He took fact and turned it into fiction, and fiction and turned it into fact. And we have a word for that in the Western world, in this English-speaking world, when somebody makes fact fiction and fiction fact and adds a little bit of scientific truth so that everything holds together, it's called a fairy tale, basically. Evolution states that all life came from the first single-celled organism, and that this single-celled organism formed by chance all on its own. Darwin was not the first person to propose this theory. The naturalists, for years before him, were proposing it. For over 200 years, the scientists and the naturalists have been performing experiments, thousands of experiments, to try to prove that a cell can form all on its own, given the right circumstances. For over 200 years, thousands of experiments. Do you know how many times an experiment proved their theory? Not once in 200 years. They say that every species evolved from a preceding species and that there's overwhelming evidence of this in the fossil record. They'll show you some sort of deceptive fossil interpretation. They'll hold up this sign where this man is like an ape, and you know, there's an ape bent over, and then there's another ape standing a little more, and all the way until you get into Neanderthal, and then after Neanderthal is the man, and there's that whole fossil record there that they have. But that's deceptive. Because what they do is, they'll look at some fragments of a skull over here, or a skeleton over here that maybe has a little bit of an ape feature. And they'll say, see, look here. It's a transitional link between ape and man. Why can't it just be an extinct form of ape? Why can't it just be an extinct form of man? Why does it have to be a transitional creature? They can never answer this. As it turns out, an evolutionist, who I'm going to quote to you, his name is Derek V, last name A-G-E-R. He's a paleontologist and an evolutionist. And this is what he writes. The point emerges that if we examine the fossil record in detail, whether at the level of order or of species, we find over and over again not gradual evolution, but the sudden explosion of one group at the expense of another. Evolutionists are saying, in the fossil record, there's no such thing as evolution. I could have a whole conversation with this man that will last 2 seconds. So you're an evolutionist? Yeah, sure am. Why? I don't know. Simple as that. Basically, what he said was, there's no transitional creatures. There's this species, and then it dies out, and then there's this one. And it came from nowhere, and it's already there. There's thousands of them out of nowhere. That's creationism. It's not evolution. Another evolutionist, Mark Zarnecki, he gives us some examples of creatures who have no evolutionary history. He says, the living honeybee is no different than its fossil relative, which is millions of years old. The 135-million-year-old dragonfly fossil is no different than its modern counterpart. A comparison of an ant fossil aged 100 million years and an ant living in our day clearly indicates that ants do not have an evolutionary history. There's no explanation of where they came from. A big problem arises when you want to start talking about the evolution of creatures that have a backbone, or that don't have a backbone, to the creatures that do have one. This would have happened in the ocean because all life originated, according to evolution, in aquatic life forms. But there's no fossil record of a transitional creature between the first fish that didn't have a backbone and the one that did. It's called invertebrate and vertebrate, and there's no transitional creature between these. All of a sudden, fish just have backbones, and the ones that didn't are dead. Nobody knows where it came from. I'm going to quote to you an evolutionist named Gerald T. Todd. He's also a paleontologist. He wrote an article titled Evolution of the Lung and the Origin of Bony Fish. And he states, all three subdivisions of bony fish first appear in the fossil record at approximately the same time. They are already widely divergent morphologically and are heavily armored. And then he asks the question to his other evolutionist friends. He says, how did they originate? What allowed them to diverge so widely? How did they all come to have heavy armor? And why is there no trace of earlier transitional forms? All of a sudden, things have backbones. He can't explain it. They're just there, like at the snap of a finger. What does the Quran tell us, Muslims? God said, be, and it was. That's creationism. Now, how many people saw the movie Jurassic Park? Show of hands. Who saw it? Everybody saw it. Everybody knows that wonderful little theory that's getting all popular, that dinosaurs evolved into birds. It was made popular by this movie, and as a result, a lot of people, even evolutionists, are starting to accept it. But is that true? I have a quote from a bird expert, a paleontologist, and an evolutionist. He covers all this. He's from the University of Kansas. And he says, to tell you the truth, if I had to support the theory that if I had to support the dinosaur origin of birds, I would be embarrassed every time I had to get up and talk about it. Every time I had to get up and talk about this silly idea, I would just be ashamed of myself, is what he's saying. Because it's not based on any truth whatsoever. It's a ridiculous viewpoint. An evolutionist named Roger Lewin writes, and this is on the subject of the evolving of mammals, which is a very difficult thing for evolutionists to explain. Where did the mammals come from? We have no clue. They just all of a sudden appear. Roger Lewin says, the transition to the first mammal, which probably happened in just one or at most two lineages, is still an enigma. What's an enigma? It means an unanswerable question. It's more than an unanswerable question. Enigma is a big word in the English language. It means we have no clue. We'll probably never be able to explain this. And I want to talk about, again, if you remember earlier, I was talking about deceptive fossil interpretations and how they'll show you a picture of, you know, a skull and somebody will draw a picture over it and it looks like an ape, transitional creature. I actually have a picture here for you. It's covered by a bunch of stuff. You'll have to give me a second. Now, there's one skull here. One skull, one fossil skull. Three different artists drew their interpretation. You see the one on this end? Just looks like an ape. Just a happy ape. The one in the middle looks like a transitional creature, some link between ape and man. But another person on this side drew a picture and it just looked like a man with a beard. The point is, in this picture, is a big problem when you want to start talking about evolution as it relates from ape to man. There's no such thing as a transitional creature. They're just making it all up. And they get some artist to come and draw a picture of what it may have looked like. And they want to propose this lie that, you know, we all came from monkeys. And there's no evidence to support that. It could just be an old extinct monkey or an old extinct man. We don't even know. Neanderthals, when you want to start talking about Neanderthals. Basically, everybody's probably heard of the Neanderthal man. There's fossil evidence to assume they exist, but they draw them as some big monkey. And, you know, everybody probably thinks they're just a stupid ape man thing. They're not. They had their own language. They use tools. The majority of evolutionists think that they bred with humans. That's not a transitional creature. That's a race of human that died out. So I got to come back and get my note cards. I want to talk a little bit about forgeries in evolution. Evolutionists become so adamant that this theory is true, and you start showing them things like this, and they have nowhere else to go, that some of them have resorted to lying and being caught. I want to give you the most famous example, which is Piltdown Man, a so-called fossil, that was discovered, according to a paleontologist named Charles Dawson. He said he discovered it in 1912 in Piltdown, England. It was a skull that clearly looked like a mix between a human and an ape. It turns out many years later that he had forged it, that it was an orangutan jaw put on a human skull. He was lying to people because he knew there was no evidence for this theory. Nebraska Man, in 1922, people were claiming that there was a tooth that they had found that would belong to the skull of a transitional link between ape and man. Turns out it was a forgery. It was a pig's tooth that they had filed down. It was not a human tooth. And the most shameful example I can give you is one that they never will tell you about in evolutionist class. Somebody called Otobinga. He was a pygmy, or a similar race. He was captured in 1904 in the Congo by evolutionist researchers. To give you a hint into his personality, his name in his native tongue meant friend. He had a wife and two children. He was nevertheless chained and caged like an animal and brought to the United States, where he was put on exhibition at the Bronx Zoo. Over him hung a sign that said, "The Ancient Ancestors of Man." Beside him, they had chimpanzees and a gorilla. The zoo's director, Dr. William T. Hornaday, he was an evolutionist, and he gave all these speeches about how happy he was to have a transitional form. But Oda Binga was a human being, and because he could not take the way he was being treated, he committed suicide. The point is, this main tenet of atheist faith, which is testable evidence, they think, because they're taught this in schools and on television, that evolution is something that can be proven through testable evidence. As hopefully we've seen here today, that's not the case. I want to give you some serious thoughts about why is evolution taught as fact in light of all of this information? Why is it proposed on all the news and everything that evolution is this great testable evidence fact that all biologists believe in? And I'm going to give you a quote from a man named Syed Hossein Nasser. Some of you saw the Muhammad Legacy of a Prophet DVD. He's in there talking. He's a very knowledgeable man. He lives here in the West. He wrote a very good book called Young Muslim's Guide to the Modern World, explaining Western culture and belief to the average Muslim. For the Muslims in the room, he uses a lot of big words and things. He's really good, very articulate. If you can stomach that, I'd say you should read the book. What he says is, much biological evidence has been brought against the theory of evolution in both its Darwinian and neo-Darwinian forms. Despite this fact, evolution continues to be taught as fact rather than theory in the majority of colleges. The reason for this is because evolutionism is a pillar of the modern worldview. Were this theory to collapse, man would be left with no option but to accept creationism. Now, he kind of subtly hints at something here, that the powers that be want evolution to be taught as a fact in school. They want us to think in it. The powers that be, maybe some of you know who I'm talking about, maybe some of you don't. I'm going to kind of get on a political rant here. The owners of these corporations, these pension plan thieves with all their friends who are crooks, the top of corporations who them it personally benefits for you to believe that there is no God, because then you partake in this thing called the modern worldview. The modern worldview, which includes things like consumerism, capitalism, supply and demand, and most importantly, pop culture. Because if we all questioned evolution, and we all really got in a huff about this, and really worried about it, we all decided that religion was the most important thing, I don't think any of us would care when the new Britney Spears album came out. I don't think any of us would try to get the better sports car. I don't think any of us would work jobs we hate for money that isn't worth it, just so we could outdo somebody else. These powers that be that have long since, all legally, through campaign contributions, bought and paid for the U.S. government, the judges, the Senate, all the people who passed the laws to keep evolution taught as fact, all of these people are the ones who want you to believe in evolutionism. They want to keep you just smart enough to be able to run the machines, use the whiteout, and answer the phone. And the reason they do this is so that you'll continue working for them and not questioning anything. And you work for them because you want to get the money, and you want to get the money so you can buy the new album or the new car. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy theory. I'm saying that's just the way the cookie crumbled. And there's only one way to stop it. They own you. Get over it. They own you. And they don't care about you. And there's only one way to stop this cycle, and that's to start questioning these things. Start doing the research. Pay a little bit of attention to these little loopholes in the theory of evolution. Okay, you can all relax. Now, there's unfortunately a third type of person that needs to be addressed in between evolutionism, atheists, and Christians. And I run into it a lot. Somebody who's too open-minded. They're just so open-minded that everything's true. Because very difficult to carry on a conversation with this person. They'll say, I'll give you some examples of two extreme views they have. One type of open-minded person will say, that's your truth. That's true for you, but that's not true for me. You must stress this point to this type of person. There is no such thing as individual truth. There are no versions of the truth. Something either is true or it isn't, but it isn't both. It goes back to that thing, two opposite things cannot be true at the same time. I'll give you an example. One time I was teaching a small part of a class in Nashville, and I wrote a document that was pretty strong because it was only for Muslims, It was titled Paul the False Apostle. And it was dealing with some of the ways to respond to some of the letters of Paul that we find in the Bible. And I stress that this is just for the Muslims. But against my wishes, one of the Muslims gave the document to a Christian. She had never read anything like that before, and she got very upset, and she wrote me a 20-page letter. And in the letter, she said, we should all just get along, and we should all just believe, be open-minded. And she said, I understand that the God of the Quran, who has no son and no father, is an opposite belief to the God of the Bible, who is a son and is a father. And I understand that that's a contradiction, but I believe them both are true. I believe in both of them, and I believe they both are true anyways. Well, unfortunately, if she were to mark that down on a logic test, and I'm not trying to be harsh, but the fact is, if she were to write that as an answer, that two opposite things can be true at the same time on a test in logic, she would be marked wrong. It's okay to tell somebody they're wrong about something, because sometimes they're wrong. Now, argument isn't going to win everybody over. If it would, even if you're right, argument's not going to win everybody over, because if it would, the world would be a different place. You need to admit that to yourself before you even get into a discussion. But then you'll run into another type of open-minded person, the type of person who says, there is no truth. They're quoting an old Greek philosopher, I forget his name, but you can really kind of throw a monkey wrench into these people's idea, somebody who comes up to you and says, there is no truth, because you can ask them, are you sure? If they say yes, well, then that's true. So you've just contradicted yourself. If there is no truth, but it's true that there's no truth, that doesn't mean anything. That's a meaningless sentence. Either there is truth or there isn't. Hopefully I haven't lost you all. But if you ask them, they say there is no truth, and you ask them, are you sure? And they say no. Well, maybe you should have another look at Islam then. You don't know if you're not sure. And I'm going to kind of close if I can just have maybe 15 or 20 more minutes. Because some of the people out there that are non-Muslim are probably thinking, okay, that's fine, you want to sit here, you want to tell me all this stuff about the Bible and about evolution, that's fine, testable evidence, whatever. But what if I applied testable evidence and your concept of faith to your religion? Does it hold up then? Maybe some of you are thinking that. Well, yes, and I'll give you some examples of why that's true. Rhetorical question, was Muhammad a prophet? Muhammad as-salatu wassalam. If somebody is claiming to be a prophet, there's only four possibilities. Either they are insane, they're out of their mind, they think they're getting a message from God when they're not. Or they're a liar, they're wanting to fool people. Or as a third answer, I get this a lot from some of my Christian family members and friends, Satan, possessed by Satan. And then the fourth and final answer is that he really was who he said he was. Those are the only four options. I can address the first two with one story in the life of the Prophet Muhammad. It is a verifiable story. All the chain of narrators are sound. It's in every history book about the life of the Prophet Muhammad, as-salatu wassalam. It is a true story. Now remember, you're thinking, is he insane or is he a liar? Let's find out. Let's find the answer to this. One of my favorite stories is when the Prophet Muhammad's son, Ibrahim, died. He was 2 years old, and he died. The day he died, there was an eclipse of the sun that day. And all the Muslims got all excited about this, and they ran to his house, and they said, it's a miracle. Your son died and the sky went dark. Now, anybody who knows anything about insane people knows that when they're in a situation of emotional distress, as he arguably would be when his son died, you're more prone to insanity. If you're insane, you're going to be even more insane when there's some problems going on. And so I submit to you that if he were insane, he would believe that. He would buy that. He would say, yeah. My son died and the sky went dark. It's a miracle. Go tell everybody. It means I'm a prophet. If he were a liar, that means he's an evil man. He's trying to fool people into thinking he's a prophet. And he's not. If he's a liar, he's evil. And he would use this to his advantage because he's an evil and selfish person. And he would say, hey, right. It means I'm a prophet. My boy died and the sky went dark. Go tell everybody. It means I'm a prophet. But that wasn't his response. His response was to become upset with the people who brought it up. He told them that was ridiculous. He said, the sun and the moon are signs of Allah, and they do not concern themselves with the birth of a child or the death of the son of Muhammad. It becomes difficult to put this man in a box and say he was insane or a liar at that point. But some people take refuge in this third option. They say he was possessed by Satan. I had somebody in my family, we were having a conversation via email, and every time I'd point out to him something in the Quran he couldn't explain, he'd say, that's the devil. came from Satan. Your book came from Satan. He was a Christian. So I pointed out to him a verse in the Bible where the Jews do that to Jesus, some of them. They come up to him and they say, they see him healing somebody. He's casting a demon out of somebody. And they say, this man doth not cast out demons, but by the power of the supreme demon, Satan. And Jesus has an interesting response. He says, any house divided against itself cannot stand. If Satan drives out Satan, his kingdom is divided against himself. He cannot stand and has an end. That's the nature of Satan as put forth by Jesus. The moment he goes against himself, whether it be through doctrine or he says something against himself or whatever, he cannot stand. He has an end. That moment, he will end. As it turns out, if you want to look to the Quran, there's several verses against Satan. But one in particular I want to address is one where the Quran itself tells us Muslims to say, before you read the Quran, you should say, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, which means, I seek refuge from Satan, the rejected one. If this is Satan's book, that's a pretty neat trick. What he basically has said was, before you read my book, please ask God to protect you from me. According to the Bible and the nature set forth by Jesus, he couldn't have done that. So, we continue this conversation through email, and he responds, and he says, well, I don't care, you know, I don't care. It came from Satan, I don't care, that's it, it came from Satan. So I responded, and I said, well, I need an explanation. He says, I don't care if you don't like it. It's not a question of whether or not I like it. It's a question of whether or not, logically, through critical thinking, that is possible, and it's not. Now, I want to give you two quick explanations from the Quran, kind of wrapping things up here, about how do we know the Quran came from God or has an origination of some divine origin. Is everybody familiar with the Big Bang Theory? Everybody in here, pretty much? I'm going to go over it real quick for you, just in summary. All the elements of the universe, according to the Big Bang Theory, existed in the same place at the same time. It formed a smoke. It's called a gaseous composition, but it's more accurately described as a smoke because it had dust and elements and particles and things like that in it. Now, this smoke received an explosion. The explosion sent all the elements of the universe flying everywhere. As a result of that explosion, the universe is expanding. This was discovered in 1950 by Dr. Hubble, and he won the Nobel Prize for it, for discovering this. It is the only accepted theory of the origin of the universe. So remember, to restate it, the universe was gas. The gas exploded and went flying. As a result, the universe is expanding. Yet we find in the Quran, the author claims he is the originator of the heavens and the earth. So surely he would know about this. In Surah chapter 41, verse 11, God informs us, then he, God, turned to the heavens when it was smoke. He got one right. Surah chapter 21, verse 30 in the Quran says, have not those who disbelieve seen the heavens and the earth were one connected entity, and we rent them asunder. It was all together and then it exploded. He got that right. Surah chapter 51, verse 47, and it is we, the royal we, God is speaking here. It is we who have constructed the heavens with might, and it is we who are steadily expanding it. He got the whole Big Bang Theory down one try, 1,400 years ago. How did he have that information? Where did that come from? Now, as a result, when you point out these scientific miracles to some of the atheists, and I've seen atheists do this, they'll say, well, first of all, the Big Bang Theory has not been debunked. Nobody knows how he knew this. But there's some other scientific theories in the Quran. The atheists will say, it's plagiarism. If you look here in Aristotle, Aristotle knew this. He worded it different, but here it's in Aristotle. And this thing you're saying is a scientific miracle. You can find it over here in ancient Greek culture. And this thing you're saying is a scientific miracle was in pre-existing Arabic culture. A lot of things they'll point at like that. They'll say it's plagiarism. First of all, Muhammad as-salam was an illiterate goat herder in the middle of the desert, so I don't think he just had a conference with all the world's top scientists and thinkers 1,400 years ago. But if you believe that, and if you want to believe in plagiarism, I have a question for you. Aristotle, ancient Arabic culture, and ancient Greek culture had a whole lot of incorrect information in their work, especially Aristotle. If the Prophet Muhammad as-salam was plagiarizing these people, how did he know to plagiarize the correct thing? Is that the miracle? It's an unanswerable question. And I want to close with one final miracle of the Quran because it's my favorite. You can find it on the internet. It's called The Literal Word and the Last Laugh. And it's a very interesting story. Around the 14th century, 14th or 16th, I didn't write it down and I forgot. You'll have to forgive me. One of the popes, his name was Pope Pius, decided he wanted to know what all this Islam thing was about. This is a verifiable story. It's true. You can check for yourself. And so he commissioned a Latin expert in his kingdom to basically translate the Quran into Latin so that he can read it. The Latin translator is translating, and he comes across this verse about a man named Haman. In the Quran, Haman is mentioned to be basically someone in the high court of the Pharaoh that had the problem with Moses. Surely you all know that story. And when the Latin translator came across this, he started laughing. Because in the Bible, Haman is much later than Pharaoh. He's in the book of Esther. He's called the enemy of the Jews, and there's all this big problems with him. And so the translator started laughing. He thought Muhammad as-salam had plagiarized the Bible. And he thought this was great. And so he wrote it down, and he takes it to the Pope. And he thought, in the course of Muhammad's plagiarizing, that he got it wrong. He made a mistake. So he takes it to the Pope. The Pope reads it, and he starts laughing. He thinks, oh, how can they believe this? It's clear in the Bible, Haman was centuries later. So anyway, they keep translating. Years later, the Quran's being translated into English by a man named George Sale. He comes across that verse. He's a Christian. He starts laughing. He's like, man, how are they still believing this? I can't believe it. Years later, the Catholic Church commissions a man named Dr. Maurice Bucaille. He's a Frenchman. And he's studying this verse about Haman in the Bible. Actually, he studies the whole Quran, and he's so impressed with what it says, he writes a book about it, about the miraculous nature of the Quran, and subsequently gets excommunicated from the Catholic Church. But he's writing, he comes across this thing about Haman. It's the one hiccup that he just, what? He takes it to a friend of his that's an Egyptian. The Egyptian is also a hieroglyphics expert. And they had just discovered a document that says that the Pharaoh that was generally accepted to be the Pharaoh at the time of Moses had somebody in his high court named Haman. Turns out that the author of the Quran knew something that nobody on the face of the earth knew at that time. And when all the popes and great religious thinkers and leaders and translators of the Quran came across it, they thought it was a joke, a lie, plagiarism. They were laughing at it. But it looks like the author of the Quran had the last laugh. And this is my final point I want to make. Some people are sitting there right now. You're Christian, maybe. And I have some questions for you. Actually, I think I have them written down, if I can find them. Just real quick, just thoughts to ponder for both the Christians and the atheists. And this is my conclusion. The Old Testament of the Bible states that people wash before prayer. Muslims do that. It's called wudu. Do Christians do that? No, they don't. Jesus was a Jew. He didn't eat any pork. Muslims don't eat pork. Do Christians? In the Garden of Gethsemane, in the Gospel of John, it says that Jesus prayed with his face to the ground. All the Jewish prophets in the Bible, at one point or another, it indicates that they prayed with their face to the ground. Do Christians pray with their face to the ground? Because Muslims do. In the Epistle of James, I believe it is, the Bible says that you should not do anything or say that you're going to do anything without first saying, if God wills. Some Christians do that, but do the majority? No, but Muslims do. We don't so much as go and say we're going to go get a glass of water without adding the phrase, inshallah, which means, if God wills. Jesus fasted in the Bible for an elongated period of time. In 2 Samuel, it is indicated that the prophets fasted during the day only and not at night. Do Christians fast? And more importantly, when they do they only do it during the day, during the daylight? Because that's how Muslims fast. The point is, Christians believe that Jesus is going to return. The Muslims believe Jesus is going to return. But the question is, who will he recognize when he gets back? Just a thought to ponder. Maybe you don't agree with the point I've made, but it's just a thought to ponder. To the atheist, I want to ask you, your idea, your philosophy, your belief is in testable evidence. But hopefully, as you've seen tonight, testable evidence does not hold up the theory of evolution, which is the cornerstone of the atheist belief. So the question to you is, if you really believe in testable evidence, who invented testable evidence, if not Imam Bukhari, when studying the Hadith? Where can testable evidence be applied, if not the Quran? And that's basically the summation. Thank you all for coming. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them for you. The Old Testament of the Bible states that people wash before prayer. Muslims do that. It's called wudu. Do Christians do that? No, they don't. No, no, no. Jesus was a Jew. He didn't eat any pork. Muslims don't eat pork. Christians? In the Garden of Gethsemane, in the Gospel of John, it says that Jesus prayed with his face to the ground. All the Jewish prophets in the Bible, at one point or another, it indicates that they prayed with their face to the ground. Do Christians pray with their face to the ground? Because Muslims do. In the Epistle of James, I believe it is, the Bible says that you should not do anything or say that you're going to do anything without first saying, if God will. Some Christians do that, but the majority?
No,
the Muslims do. We don't so much as go and say we're going to go get a glass of water without adding the phrase inshallah, which means if God will. Jesus fasted in the Bible for an elongated period of time. In 2 Samuel, it is indicated that the prophets fasted during the day only, not at night. Do Christians fast? And more importantly, when they do they only do it during the daylight? Because that's how Muslims fast. The point is, Christians believe that Jesus is going to return. Muslims believe Jesus is going to return. But the question is, who will he recognize when he gets back? Just a thought to ponder. Maybe you don't agree with the point I made, but it's just a thought to ponder.
We once had a teacher. The teacher of teachers, he changed the world for the better.